and welcome to A Bookish Home. I'm your host, librarian and writer Laura Zara-Papinski, and on this episode, I'm chatting with author Sarah McCraw Crowe. Her debut novel, The Wrong Kind of Woman, is about a woman who finds her way through grief when she helps bring the women's movement to an all-male college campus in the early 1970s, and it's wonderful. A little about Sarah. Sarah McCraw Crowe's articles and short stories have run in many magazines and literary journals. She's a graduate of Dartmouth College, Stanford University, and Vermont College of Fine Arts, and she lives on an old farm in New Hampshire with her family. Sarah McCraw Crowe, welcome to A Bookish Home. I'm really looking forward to chatting with you.
Oh, thank you, Laura. I'm so happy to be here. Thanks.
Yes. This was one of those experiences where it made me so happy I do the podcast because I was so happy that this book crossed my path, and then to know that I was going to get to chat about it with you after just made me so happy as I was reading. So it, it was just really thought-provoking. I thought it was so beautifully written. I was savoring it, but at the same time, really wanted to just keep turning those pages. So a big congratulations on the book. And I know it's getting rave reviews as well. And I did want to mention, too, I also think that this would be such a great book club pick for people. So if anyone's listening, kind of wondering what they should pick for their next book club meeting, there's so much to discuss here. But, to go into the story a little bit, I wanted to start with the quote that is on the cover, which I really love, from Carol Rifka Brunt. And it calls the book a glorious debut filled with characters grasping to find a place to belong in a world on the edge of change. And I would love to hear from you a little bit about the characters we meet in the novel and, what is going on in their lives and really the world at the time that the book takes place.
Oh, sure. Well, thank you for those kind words. That makes my day. Thank you. I really appreciate it. And yes, it has been, book clubs have been the best part, I think, maybe. I mean, not the best part, but it's been such an enjoyable part of publishing a novel because people have so many interesting questions and they want to share their own experiences, which has been kind of amazing, especially women who were either in college in the early 70s or have academic experience. And that's been, it's been an education for me as well. So that's been really great. So The Wrong Kind of Woman is sort of an academic novel. I mean, it's set in 1970 and 71 around the campus of Clarendon College, which is loosely based on Dartmouth College before co-education. And the three characters are all, they're all sort of insiders and outsiders at the same time, I would say. Virginia, my character Virginia is really at the heart of the story. And when her husband, Oliver, who was a history professor at Clarendon, dies very suddenly in his early 40s, she's sort of forced to reassess so many things about herself and her marriage and just her understanding of her world. And even to the point of realizing that so much of what she saw of her world was through Oliver's perspective. So that's sort of Virginia. And then her daughter, Rebecca, is 13, which is the worst of all possible ages. And she's just, just missing her dad. And she's kind of coming adrift, losing her best friend and trying to figure out what's going to happen next for her. And then Sam is a Clarendon student, and he's mathematically and musically talented and, a smart guy, but he is lonely because he doesn't fit in very well at Clarendon because Clarendon is a little bit animal housey and pretty jockey and waspy. And Sam is just not sure what his grief about Oliver says about him. So that's sort of where they all are when the book kicks off, I would say.
Yeah. And I think, I think I read somewhere that you sort of described Virginia's story as sort of being at the heart of it. And I was so drawn to her. And I think I'm probably not alone in being very drawn to books that allow me to experience what it would have been like to be a woman in different times and having, you know, very different experiences than my own. So I was just so compelled by her story. And, you know, it's not very far away, but it's a world away. And so what drew you to sort of her story and exploring what it would have been like to be on this college campus as a woman in the early 1970s, although she's not a student, she's, trying to teach there and is the wife of the professor, but.
Right. Yeah. Well, a couple of things I would say. And one is I do have this kind of weird fascination with those colleges like Dartmouth that were all male for so long and who, you know, were kind of brought kicking and screaming into co-education. Like none of them wanted to do that. And when I was at Dartmouth, it was in the late 80s and it was pretty co-ed, but there were all these reminders of the times when, you know, before when it was all male. And I just wondered what it would be like to be somebody like Virginia, if you were, let's say you were working at a school like that, or you were an early exchange student, a female student, or an early woman student after the school went co-ed, like what would that have been like? And that just was kind of always in the back of my head. And then the other thing that was in the back of my head, really since I don't know how long, maybe forever, but just that sort of fascination with my mom's generation and what was their life like when they were young? Like, how did they manage the choices that were available to them? Because Virginia, going to grad school, she would have been going to grad school in the 60s or even the 50s. And that was pretty unusual to be thinking about a PhD back then. So I just wondered about those women, like how, you know, where could they go to college and what could they study when they went to college and what could they do after college that, you know, how, what if they wanted to be sort of ambitious? You know, what if you were Ruth Bader Ginsburg? How did you navigate the world? So that was just sort of percolating for a long time. But I will say that when I was first writing these pages, I thought I was just writing about a marriage and I was writing, pages from Virginia's perspective and then from Oliver's perspective. And at first, Oliver was not dead. He was, you know, just, you know, complaining into my head and that kind of thing. So I have all these pages from his perspective. But I pretty quickly figured out that he was not really part of the story and he had to go.
Oh, that's so interesting. I was just kind of rereading different things I had marked in the book and she does have sort of those flashbacks and the memories of Oliver. And there's a point where they're sort of having an argument about, she's saying, you know, I think she says, where is it written that I need to do all the cooking and the cleaning and the shopping and everything else? And he's sort of saying, oh, but it's so hard. I work. And I just had to mark down. He says, it's not easy when your wife has professional ambitions. And I just was like, oh.
And that is, I mean, that was 50 years ago. So that was a long time ago. But some of that stuff, I mean, obviously those, we all still have those negotiations about the domestic stuff and how we're going to get those things done. And I do think in my imagining of Oliver, like if he were a real person and you could sit him down and ask him, he would say, I'm very progressive. You know, I want all these things for my wife and I'm happy to be doing this. And I wanted Virginia to just be angry and starting to access her anger, but I also wanted to try to get at those things that are still, they're still sort of with us today. I mean, the same with all the difficulties with academia for women. There's a lot that really hasn't changed all that much.
Yes. And, you know, that I think, well, it just seems like most generations would hope that things continue to get better for their daughters. I know at one point she's thinking to herself, you know, that maybe when her daughter goes to college, everything will be different. And I feel like that's something that continues, not necessarily about college, but just about so many things. You know, I hope that this or that is better when it's my daughter's turn. You know, I know that you had said that you spoke with you know, during your research, women who had experienced this time on those New England campuses. And I would love to hear more about that and some of the things that stood out to you that they mentioned and just what they were kind of eager to share about their experiences.
Yeah, well, it is, you can sort of imagine that the women who would be willing to be an exchange student at one of the men's schools or to be an early admit as a woman would be pretty, confident and maybe not hard charging, but they would know what they wanted. And everyone, they all had stories that were sort of a mix of, it was really hard and some of the guys were just awful and the alums were ridiculous. But then they would have stories of like great friendships they made and that kind of thing. So they were, everyone would seeming to try to be balanced in their stories. But a couple things that stuck with me were, so in the case of Dartmouth, and this is something I knew a little bit about too, there was like a song called the Quahog Song that I sort of fictionalized in that there's a scene where there's a fraternity singing competition and one of the frats sings a rude song and all hell kind of breaks loose. And that was loosely based on a real singing competition and a real song that got sung to early women at Dartmouth. That was just an awful, degrading song. And I was struck by a couple of women that I interviewed. So these were women who were during the time of the first couple of years of co-education. So after Dartmouth went co-ed, and hearing that song sung in like a sort of official setting and then seeing the dean of faculty give first prize to this horrible song just really took their breath away. They could not believe that this was happening and that it was sort of officially condoned to be just misogynistic and that kind of thing. So I think it was pretty hard, I think would be the bottom line.
Yeah. It was interesting too. I know, or I could imagine just from some of what was written that it would have been a very stark difference for some of the women who had experienced sort of more welcoming college campuses. Virginia has fond memories of being at Smith, and mm-hmm. It struck me there was this line at Smith, she'd felt powerful for the first and last time. Did any of them have a similar experience where they maybe went to a women's college and then transferred to one of these schools or maybe went for grad school?
Well, yeah, I've heard all across the spectrum on that. And during my research and also when I've been talking to book clubs, you know, people really wanting to defend that single sex experience and how much it mattered to them and how they had that experience like Virginia did. And so some of the women that I talked to, you know, they were ready. They were sort of done with that after a couple of years and they were ready to be, you know, swimming in the big pool as they saw it, you know, to be going to school with men. And then other women that, you know, to have even like an exchange period with a little bit of that all male type school was enough. So, but I did want to sort of get at that a little bit for Virginia because I think if you were somebody like her, you would probably have ambivalent feelings about your own experience, you know, in a single sex school. I'm sure the women at Smith in the 40s and 50s were like super smart and high achieving. And, you know, that must've been a great place to be. And so you would have a hard time wanting to let that go, I would think, while maybe not wanting that for your daughter. So, mm-hmm. I just wanted to get at some of that ambivalence.
So interesting. Well, you know, I would love to hear about how you got started just sort of weaving these different stories together and how you juggled the different perspectives. And I always love to hear too, just that you know, that common question, are you a plotter or a pantser? Sort of, what was your process like bringing the story together and like figuring out where it was all going to go?
Right. Yeah, I'm definitely a pantser. I am not a plotter. I have tried to plot various things as I've worked on various stories and novels, and that just, it doesn't work for me. So as I think I mentioned before, that when I started writing these pages, I started with Virginia, and then I thought, oh, I'm writing about a marriage. And so I was writing these pages in Virginia's point of view and Oliver's point of view, and other characters started to pop up. Like Sam cropped up just pretty much fully formed. He was just there. Like, I didn't know everything about him, but I knew kind of a lot. And I didn't know, at first he was just sort of like, okay, I'll follow this for a little bit and see if it leads me to some useful insight about Oliver or something like that. And then it became, I felt like, oh, Sam has more of a place here. And that was when I was also realizing, like, Oliver has to go, I have to kill him. And then I can, the other characters, you know, things can start happening. And then Rebecca was just, I'm not sure when Rebecca came in, but she was very easy to write because it's not that hard to go back to 13 and 14. And you're sort of not one thing or the other. You're kind of longing for your childhood, but you're so ready to be done with it and yet not ready for the next thing. And so those pages just, I'm not even really sure why I started writing her pages, but they were just, those just kind of flowed out. And her grief felt, one thing that was, as I was working on this, the sort of different kinds of grief that these characters move through, you know, Rebecca's grief is just pure. She's just missing her dad. And Virginia's is more complicated, and Sam would rather pretend that he's not feeling anything like grief. He's kind of put that in a box, I think.
It's really interesting. You know, as you're talking about kind of following these different characters and figuring out maybe where they're going to take you and who they are, from the nitty gritty writing perspective, it makes me curious because I've been doing some of this too. And sort of, what is your writing like actual routine? Sort of like, are you jotting this down in a Word document? Are you using Scrivener? Are you going on different pages or sections of a notebook? How are you approaching that?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I would say I usually, but not always, when I'm working on something that's newish, I start writing by hand in a notebook because something about the notebook feels like I'm not committed to it. I can just write and see what comes up and, you know, write for a few pages. And usually once I get going, I will just keep going and I can write, you know, 30 pages, 50 pages in a notebook pretty quickly. And then once I've gotten a certain amount of pages, then I sort of start again and put it into a Word document and just stick with that. But it would be certainly be better if I had a plan, you know, when starting to write and an outline, because this is more of a process of, I guess, character discovery and who's, you know, which characters are going to stick around. Like another character that I followed for quite a while and I have a bunch of pages in her point of view is a background character named Elodie, who was more of a radical activist and the young woman that Sam falls for or thinks he's falling for. And that was a character that I just never could quite get inside her head. And I never could quite figure out, is she a true believer or is she just like a rich girl who's kind of fooling around with this? And I decided, okay, I'm just going to let her perspective go and let her be sort of a cipher in the background. And, but that wasn't, it wasn't like I planned that. It just was like, I tried it and it wasn't really working as a point of view character. And actually it's funny, thinking about that just now, I read an interview with Joshua Henkin the other day, and he said something like, I have to bark up a lot of wrong trees before I bark up the right tree. And obviously he's such an accomplished writer. And he's written, I think, a whole bunch of novels, but I like that idea of just, as a writer, it's okay. You bark up the wrong tree and then you realize, okay, that's the wrong tree. I'm going to go bark up this other tree. And, I know that sounds daunting to people who are thinking about doing a big project like a novel, but I think it's okay if you just approach it in the spirit of I'm exploring and let's see what comes out of it. And honestly, I don't think the stuff that you write that ends up on the cutting room floor is really lost, because it, whatever it is, it teaches you something. It teaches you about the other characters or some action that did or didn't need to take place, that kind of thing.
I think that's such a great perspective, and seeing it as an exploration. And it makes me wonder too, I read, maybe it was in an interview with you talking about how, I think you had some other novels that you had completed. And I think you had said that one got you your agent, and it makes me wonder, but that one didn't get published. Do you sort of see the whole book that way too? That's sort of following some of those other projects informed this novel and kind of helped you get there. I guess I'm sort of just getting into what your writing journey was like.
Yeah. Okay. So yes, my writing journey has been, I'll back up for a second and say my writing journey has been kind of a long one, although I didn't start taking fiction seriously until I was almost 40. So I have written for my whole career, but mainly for magazines. And I was a magazine staffer in my 20s, and then I did a lot of freelancing for women's magazines. But I didn't think, I mean, I noodled around in private, but I never would have taken a creative writing class in college. I just didn't think I was that person. I thought creative writers were like this other special class, and I didn't belong to that class. So, but I, you know, you get older and then your kids get older and you get less afraid. So I started taking classes when I was probably 39. And so then I have a couple novels in the drawer, like many writers do. And at some point, so I spent kind of a long time on a historical novel that was very different from this one. And that is the novel that you mentioned. That is the novel that got me an agent. And it was about the sister of the artist John Singer Sargent. So it was set mostly in the late 19th century and early 20th century in Paris and London. So that novel, I spent probably 6 months just doing research before I started writing. And then I spent 6 or 7 years on that novel. And it wasn't full time, because I was doing my other writing and book reviewing and stuff like that. But I spent a long time on it, and it was great that it got me an agent, but it never sold. And that's not uncommon for, you know, when you first get an agent and that first novel goes out on submission, as readers, we don't hear about the novels that didn't sell. We hear about the ones that did sell. But while I was querying, and while that John Singer Sargent, Emily Sargent novel was out on submission, I started another project, and that's what turned into The Wrong Kind of Woman. And that's a piece of advice that writers give each other, which is there's going to be a lot of waiting. You know, when you're querying agents, that could take you a year to before you land with an agent. And when your book is out on submission, you need to be doing something else. So write, start a new project, go back to an old project, whatever, just do something else. And that worked very well for me. And also, starting something that was set in 1970 was just such a relief to be, I'm in the 20th century, I know this century, and I don't have to like spend 6 months researching before I start. So, those earlier novels were practice novels. And, you know, there are some people that don't have to do that, but there are many more writers who do. You have to practice to learn how to write fiction. So,
yeah, this is why I love pulling that curtain back, because I think it is very inspiring and encouraging. I feel like there have been so many authors who have come on and have talked about the book they had to kind of abandon in the drawer, but that taught them so much and helped give them that practice. And for sure, I think it helps give the rest of us that motivation maybe to keep trying.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I was wondering too on kind of your writing journey, if there were, writing communities or groups or writing friendships that helped you a lot along the way, or that you still really lean on now?
Well, several of them. And they've changed a little bit over the years. And I have been in several different writing groups that usually would form after, taking a class. When you take a writing class, a lot of times you'll connect with a couple of people that you feel like you kind of get their work and they get your work, and you decide to exchange writing after the class ends. And so I've done that a few times. And then I've had one writing group that has lasted a lot longer, although right now it's just down to me and one other woman. And she's sort of my stalwart writing friend, and we pretty much read everything for each other. And then other groups have been more like, I would say, writing organizations like Grub Street in Boston and Vermont College of Fine Arts, where I did my MFA. They have just some nice kind of continuing, trying to keep people connected, and it's sort of virtual, I guess. But and then I have other people that I've exchanged things with periodically that I've met through conferences and things like that. And then beyond that, I have friends who aren't writers, but they're just really astute readers, and they will read for me when I have something that's, gotten to a certain point.
I love that. And it's nice. I like Grub Street a lot. I've taken one of their classes before, and it's nice that so much is offered virtually now. So yes. hopefully that continues.
Well, I hope so too, because I'm in New Hampshire, they're in Boston. So
yeah, that's a bit of a trek. That makes me wonder too, what it's been like to have this debut novel come out during kind of a tricky time to be promoting a book, but then at the same time, maybe some of it has been positive with all the virtual events and things, but mm-hmm. So what's it been like to bring the book out into the world?
Yeah. I mean, it was a disappointment realizing, the pandemic is still going, because this was this past fall. And you remember when we first were thinking about the pandemic, we thought, oh, it'll be a few weeks or whatever we thought.
Yeah.
I don't know. I can't say what it would be like I don't really have the experience of what it would be like to have gone to different cities and bookstores and places where I know people, where I would have had my events. But because of the virtual things, I could do events with writers in, my launch events were with writers in other places, and they were conversations. And that's one thing I love about the virtual events, that they're usually conversations. They're not one author. When you go to a bookstore event, and in the olden days before the pandemic, it was an author would come and stand up and talk a little bit and then answer questions. But when it's virtual, you have two authors talking to each other, and it just seems to be a richer, maybe not always, but I really like that format. I like the two authors talking to each other.
Yeah.
So that's been great. And I do think that I've had some, a wonderful kind of, it's a marketing group, but it's been a wonderfully supportive group of debut authors, the people who debuted in 2020. And that's, of course, all virtual too, and just on Facebook. But it has been really great to get to know some of those writers too. So there's been a lot of silver linings. And and the fact that everyone knows how to do Zoom. So I've done a lot of Zoom book clubs, and even older women, you don't have to say like, this is what Zoom is, this is how you do it. Everybody yes. knows how to do it.
Everyone knows how to do it now.
Yeah. So that's been kind of great.
Yeah. And that was going to be one of my questions too. Are you somebody who enjoys the sort of marketing and promotion side, or is it, how do I fit that in with also trying to write?
Well, I will say that those are two different parts of your brain, and it is very hard to be thinking in that marketing way, either posting on Instagram or thinking about I don't know, pitching yourself to a bookstore or something like that. That's just so different than like the kind of dreamy creative mind that that writing calls for. So, and it's hard to know what is a, you know, what should people be doing? Like how much marketing should you be doing? And so those are all just like kind of big question marks for me. And I don't think anyone can really answer. And I think, you know, you probably should try to put yourself out there when you can and know when you need to pull back and just be writing. But yeah, I can't say that I enjoy that part of like, hey, look at me. That's definitely not really my forte.
I think that's probably the case for lots of writers.
I'm surprised at how many writers are, you know, they like the spotlight. They don't mind it. So
maybe they're good at faking it. Well, you know, that led me to want to ask you, and I know you've touched on this a little bit, but do you have any particular writing advice you've received that you still find really helpful or anything that you would share with aspiring writers?
Yeah, I guess one would be, I mean, I guess you could apply this a little bit to any stage of your writing career, which is give yourself permission. So when you're first getting started, you just have to give yourself permission to write something terrible and not worry about what it is. Because despite what you may think, writing doesn't flow out of people's pens or computers just like perfectly on the first draft. So you just have to give yourself permission to get started and write a shitty first draft, like Anne Lamott says. And I think you can take that phrase and apply it to later phases of your writing years as well. Just, you know, keep giving yourself permission to either try something different or take a break or whatever it is at the time. And I mean, it's kind of related to cut yourself some slack, but not quite the same thing. But I think that would be my main thing. That and just read a lot and read the books that you love. Go back and read them again and think about, why do I love this book? What is calling to me? And how can I let this inspire me to write my own thing?
I think that's great advice. And I did want to ask you about your reading life. I'd love to hear what you've been reading lately. And I also was wondering if you could touch on, I did see that you do reviews for BookPage, and I would love to hear a little bit about kind of turning on your reader reviewer brain and writing as well.
Yeah. Well, I do. I mean, reading is my main hobby in the world. It's my main thing I love to do. So I mentioned Joshua Henkin, and his new book is called Morningside Heights. And I don't know if you've read that book, but I just loved it. I thought it's a story about a marriage, and it came out in June, maybe. Yeah, I think it came out in June. And it's about a couple, a long marriage, and the husband gets Alzheimer's. But it kind of follows them from like the early 70s through now. And it changes perspective also. It's in mostly in the perspective of Prue, the wife, but it's also in the perspective of the two kids. And it was beautiful. And there's some kind of wry humor, and I highly recommend that one. And what else? Anthony Doerr has a novel coming in October called Cloud Cuckoo Land. I don't know if you've had a chance to read that one yet. Well, it is. I'm going to be very interested to see what people think of it, because it's definitely recognizable Anthony Doerr, but there's it's kind of this crazy kaleidoscopic plot, and I think there are six point of view characters, and two of them are in 1453 Constantinople, and one is 100 years in the future on a spaceship, and is in the late 50s, one is in the present day. I mean, and it bounces around, and then it's, they're all connected by this one ancient Greek manuscript, a fable by Diogenes. And as you're starting it, you're like, how is this going to tie together? I do not see how this is going to happen, but it does. And it's beautifully resolved. But I don't know if people are looking for the, you know, all the light we cannot see. It's very different from that. So, but I thought it was wonderful.
Yeah. Well, I'll definitely have to check those out. And then do you, for your book reviews, are you, sort of getting sent and assigned things, or are you picking things that you want to review and write about? How does that work?
Yeah, there's a little bit of both. So the editors will say, well, so now this is different. I mean, different reviewing. So early review outlets, you know, all the different places do things differently. And like if I were doing, I used to do a lot of more reviewing for literary magazines, and that's more like you just say, can I review something? And they'll, that's much more, I guess, fluid. And, but for a magazine like Book Page, they will send around a list of, you know, here's what's coming for December, you know, give us your top three choices and we'll let you know. And you don't always get your top choice. And so that, it's a little bit, I mean, I try to pick books that I think I would like to read anyway, but I also try to pick books that are just a little bit outside my comfort zone to try, you know, different things. And because you do have to say, you know, choose several, it's, you're not always going to get the exact book you think you're going to get. So yeah. And the reviewer hat is a little different than just, I feel like I read, when I read to review, I read as a reader first, and then I go back and think about, it's a little bit more like reading like a writer. When you read like a writer, you read, you know, you read for story, but you also read for like, you know, how is this put together? What is the, how does the time frame work? What's the structure? That kind of thing. And so it's a little more of a, you know, going over a book several times and thinking about it and in different ways and from different perspectives.
Well, it's nice to get to be immersed in books in so many ways, in your reviews, in your regular reading life, in your writing. So that's great. Well, yeah. You know, I'd love to hear just lastly what you're working on now. Sometimes I know you can't share, but if there's something you can share.
Oh yeah, no, it's not a secret, but it is not. I don't know what the story is yet. I am working on, I have a lot of pages that are set in the early 80s in this new thing I'm working on. And I think it's a family story, but it has a speculative aspect. And I also have some pages set in the 1920s. So I really wish I was farther along because I've been working on this for a while. But it's I'm somewhere in between mush and first draft, I would say, even though I've probably written, I don't know, 400 pages or something. I guess I'm not making a very good argument for my way of writing because it's not very efficient. but yeah, it's pretty, there's some things that are similar because there is one character who's a little bit, almost like a version of Louise from The Wrong Kind of Woman, who's more of an academic kind of career person. But other than that, it's remains to be seen what this novel is going to be.
Well, I love the idea of going back and forth between the 1920s and the 80s. That seems like it would be just really an interesting kind of juxtaposition. Well, I will definitely look forward to getting to read that when it's published.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, you know, I so hope that people go pick up The Wrong Kind of Woman. I hope that book clubs choose it. And I know you had said on your website, and I know you mentioned that you do sometimes Zoom with book clubs. So I'll definitely put the link to your website if people maybe want to look into doing that. I'm sure it would be exciting to get to chat with you for a book club. And if people are looking to sort of follow along with you online, is there somewhere on social media that you tend to be the most?
I'm probably mostly on Instagram, I would say. I'm on Facebook too, and it just I'm enjoying Instagram more lately. I'm on Twitter somewhat, but I think Instagram is my sort of comfortable place at this point. And I think my handle is Sarah McCraw Crow, but I think it also comes up if you just Google my name. You know how Google does stuff these days, that your Instagram and Facebook and stuff comes right up. So.
Perfect. And I'll link to your website too. And I know you have events and things listed on there.
Yes.
Well, thank you so much, Sarah, for coming on. And it was such a wonderful read. So thank you for sharing it with all of us.
Oh, thank you, Laura. It was such a pleasure talking to you. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
For links to all of the books mentioned on this week's episode, you can visit abookishhome.com. And there you'll also find a link to our new online bookshop. A Bookish Home has teamed up with the new organization bookshop.org, which supports independent bookstores. And if you'd like, you can browse books by authors who have been guests on A Bookish Home. I'm also sharing there all of the books mentioned on the podcast, books I've been reading lately, and other recommendations. It's a really wonderful site to browse and look through books. And if you make a purchase, it supports A Bookish Home and independent bookstores. So it's a win-win. So if you want to check that out directly, it's bookshop.org/shop/abookishhome. And you'll also find that at abookishhome.com. If you are enjoying the show, I hope you take a minute to subscribe and also rate and review in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you enjoyed this episode, I would encourage you to share it on social media to help other people find the show and this episode. Thanks for listening, everyone, and happy reading.